On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's showdown time this week on executive privilege, on science and politics, and above all, on the war in Iraq. At the White House yesterday, the president called the divide as he sees it.
The real debate over Iraq is between those who think the fight is lost or not worth the cost, and those who believe the fight can be won.
On Capitol Hill, the House voted for pullout. Democrat Nancy Pelosi called the tally.
The yeas are 223. The nays are 201. The bill is passed.
And former Bush Surgeon General Richard Carmona testified to the problems he faced.
The reality is that the nation's doctor has been marginalized and relegated to a position with no independent budget and with supervisors who are political appointees with partisan agendas.
Joining us today to dig into the headlines, from the campaign trail in New Hampshire, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, great to have you again. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me back, Tom.
With us from New York is Steve Spruill, staff writer for the National Review and National Review Online. Steven Spruill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Tom, Karen, and Steve.
Steve Spruill, first to you. Sound and fury all over the Iraq issue this week. What does it signify, sir?
Well, I think events on the Iraq debate could not have been more momentous this week. It's everything short of the White House and Capitol Hill rolling out cannons and just lobbing shots at each other across Pennsylvania Avenue. You had the president coming out in a press conference yesterday saying that he needed more time and wanted Congress to wait until September when General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker are set to report on progress in Iraq. And then hours later, you had the House just directly reprimanding the president with this vote to withdraw all American troops by April 1st. So it's really broken out into open hostilities between the executive and legislative branches.
The president could clearly feel that coming, not just from Democrats, but we've got some Republican defectors very prominently in the Senate in particular. Here at his press conference yesterday, he had forceful remarks on Congress's role in determining the future of the war effort.
I don't think Congress ought to be running the war. I think they ought to be funding our troops. I'm certainly interested in their opinion, but trying to run a war through resolution is a prescription for failure, as far as I'm concerned, and we can't afford to fail. I'll work with Congress. I'll listen to Congress. Congress has got all the right to appropriate money. But the idea of telling our military how to conduct operations, for example, or how to, you know, deal with troop strength I don't think it makes sense. I don't think it makes sense today, nor do I think it's a good precedent for the future.
Prescription for failure, the president says, Karen Tumulty, of Congress getting involved here. Of course, as critics say, that's the path we're on already. Failure. What do you make of the debate, Karen?
Well, at this point, it's important to remember that this House resolution that passed yesterday, probably anything that passes in the Senate, is going to be with a well short of a veto-proof majority.
Right.
So the president really still has the leverage here. But as you suggested, Tom, what's interesting to watch here are the Republicans. They only lost 4 Republican votes in the House yesterday. But in the Senate, a number of Republicans are coming out more and more publicly in favor of putting some kind of limits, some kind of timeline on this war. I think it was absolutely devastating a few weeks ago when they lost Senator Richard Lugar, who is one of the most respected voices in his party on foreign policy. This feels like the beginning of a big movement in the Republican Party.
A big movement in the Republican Party. But, Jack, does it mean movement on Iraq war policy, actual policy on the ground?
Well, there's some talk, of course, that the administration is going to shift policy come September, that they're going to talk about something more like a redeployment toward training and standing down from the surge. We'll have to see about that. But, you know, the dominant reality is the people, and the Congress, the Democrats in the lead, but some Republicans following, are desperately trying to catch up with the 70% of the public that wants out of Iraq by next spring. And for the Republicans, Republicans, it's an especially desperate chase because of Bush's popularity. 26% nationally, only one state in the union, Utah, where he's above 50%. He's as low as 35% in Montana. That means for every Republican running in 2008, they almost have to put distance between themselves and the president, and especially between themselves and this, the most unpopular policy of the president. And for the Democrats, they have to deliver. Polls show a loss of faith in them, strikingly among Democratic voters who perhaps unreasonably, perhaps not, expected them to legislate an end to the war. So both parties and the president have much at stake here.
You could feel the weight on the president's shoulders this week of the war in particular. Here was a notable moment in Cleveland on Tuesday. The president speaking to the Greater Cleveland Partnership, hand-picked audience, brings up the war. Listen for the sigh.
I want to talk about this war we're in. First of all, I regret I had to tell you we're in war.
Karen, it's a little mangled there at the end, but that sigh spoke volumes to me. I mean, this is there have been a lot of rough moments. It's hard to say. You know, we keep hearing week after week, maybe this is a meltdown moment, but this White House is really carrying a load of troubles at this point.
That's right. And they are finding themselves more and more isolated. And wherever the president goes, he is not finding much support for the war, even, you know, now that the Republican base in most polls seems to be slipping as well. This is a president who's looking at, you know, a lot of months left in office and not much support.
Stephen Spruill, you write for conservative publications. You bring a particular eye to this. What do you make of the president's moment on the war and more broadly? I mean, what happens with all these months remaining, those low poll numbers Jack's looking at, the defections within the GOP? What's your analysis of what's going on here, where it takes us?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to remember when it comes to the Republicans and the reported defections specifically. Now, the way I understand it, in the Senate, you still have a coalition of Republicans who are going to hang together until September. Now, that's going to be the really decisive moment when we see whether or not Mitch McConnell's coalition is going to hold together. As of now, the only defections that are significant are the senators who are supporting the Salazar-Alexander Amendment to write into law the Iraq Study Group recommendations. Now, that would not set a firm deadline for withdrawal, so it hasn't garnered the support of enough Democrats to pass. So right now, you don't have an immediate threat with Senate defections. But come September, that could be a different story. When it comes to the 08 candidates, however, you saw something very interesting. As McCain's campaign was imploding this week, you saw him take to the Senate floor and become an absolute stalwart on remaining in Iraq, letting Petraeus have the time that he needs to implement the surge strategy. And so it's almost as if McCain feels this is a way to reestablish his credentials with the base after the immigration debacle.
Let's listen to McCain, as you say, on the floor of the Senate after his return this week from Baghdad.
Many of my colleagues would like to believe that should any of the various amendments forcing withdrawal become law, it would mark the end of this long effort. They are wrong. Should the Congress force a precipitous withdrawal from Iraq, it would mark a new beginning, start of a new, more dangerous, more arduous effort to contain the forces unleashed by our disengagement. Already the terrorists are emboldened, excited that America is talking not about winning in Iraq, but is rather debating when we should lose.
Karen Tumblety here, the McCain campaign and the Iraq war debate intersect. Big staffers gone from the McCain campaign this weekend, and more departures to come, we're told. Stephen Spruill uses the word imploding. Do you see it that way? And can John McCain get his footing back by being gung-ho on such an unpopular war?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that, you know, this speech was as Senator McCain was returning from Iraq. I think that he is where he is on Iraq because he really believes this. I mean, he has been a supporter of the war and a supporter of the surge, and he has not wavered in that. And interestingly enough, you have seen some of the other 08 Republican candidates, in fact, are becoming more and more open about their misgivings about the surge. Mitt Romney is, in particular, Rudy Giuliani even. But where the McCain campaign finds itself right now is, in fact, you know, in an absolute desperate situation. The primary problem, the primary immediate problem, is that they have run out of money. While fundraising has been somewhat disappointing, the fact is that this senator, who has been such a staunch, you know, voice in Washington for, you know, cutting down on excessive government spending, has run a campaign that has just hemorrhaged money, and they are down to, what they're saying is, about $2 million left in the bank. In presidential political terms, that's fumes. In fact, they have a lot of debts against that. So what they really have are a few a few hundred thousand dollars. And it's really hard to see how you climb out of a hole like that. And I think the bigger problem was that they were really trying to take a candidate whose primary appeal has always been that he's an outsider, that he's a, you know, it's a cliche that he's a maverick. And they were trying to fit him into the mold of a very, very conventional front-running candidate. They were basically trying to run the playbook that has always worked for conventional Republicans, and John McCain has just not fit that mold.
We're looking at a week in the news. Congress confronts Bush on Iraq. White House aides won't talk. McCain in trouble. A kind of interim report on benchmark progress out of Iraq. The president was holding up what he saw as good in it. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid was having none of it. Here he is at a press conference yesterday on the president's claims of progress.
We're told good progress is being made. Wait till September. Good progress is being made. How many times over the last 4.5 years have we heard this? Too many to number.
Harry Reid, yesterday, let's get our listeners in here. From Nashville, John, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Tom. And I was just calling in about John McCain. I see a lot of energy being spent analyzing his fall in the polls and his apparent fall from grace. I think a lot of it is not so much that he's run away from the Republican base as much as he's run too close to President Bush on the immigration bill and on this war in Iraq. 70% of the people in America are against this war, and no Republican is going to win running on the war in Iraq.
So you think he looks like Bush, too, and people don't want it? But what about Giuliani? What about Romney? Are they so different from the president on these fronts?
Well, I don't really think that Giuliani's campaign is really doing that well either. I think that there are other people in the Republican race that are not being looked at that are doing better. If we look at the past three Republican presidential debates, the candidate that came out on top on two of them and came in second place on one of them was Dr. Ron Paul. And he took a position at the very beginning of the war, being against the war.
Yeah, we've talked to him, and he does great on those online polls. But, you know, when you get the scientific pollers out there, well, he's practically invisible. But we hear it, John, and thank you very much, Jack.
Yeah, you know, John raises the question of how different is Rudy Giuliani, say, on the war. Well, ominously, to my point of view, it was announced this week that Giuliani has made Norman Podhoretz one of his foreign policy advisors. And Podhoretz is on record as saying it is a success in Iraq, that things are going well. It's just the press that's reporting, giving us this slanted reporting. And he's just written a big piece calling for an attack on Iran. So if that's the kind of counsel that that Rudy is listening to, it doesn't strike me that he's putting much distance between himself and the war.
I want to look at another front when it comes to the White House and executive privilege. Of course, this week we heard Sarah Taylor, President Bush's former political director, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, was it, or House hearing on Wednesday about the firings of 8 U.S. attorneys. She refused to disclose to senators any internal White House discussions on the matter.
The current dispute between the executive and congressional branches of our government is much bigger than me or my testimony here today. In light of the president's direction, I will answer faithfully those questions that are appropriate for a private citizen to answer, while also doing my best to respect the president's directive.
There's Sarah Taylor. Of course, they wanted Harriet Myers and her paperwork, too. She asserted she didn't need to show up to testify before Congress on the firings. The panel majority disagreed. We may see more on that front. Here's Tennessee Democratic Congressman Stephen Cohen.
I can't fathom a private citizen getting a subpoena to come before this body and not showing up. What we've got here is an empty chair. I mean, that is as contemptuous as anybody can be.
Karen Tumulty, where does this go?
Well, I think it looks like it's going to the courts. And this is a fight that could drag on after President Bush is out of office. I mean, almost every president has had some sort of conflict with Congress over executive privilege, and it's almost always resolved with some kind of deal, you know, some kind of negotiation. I think famously Ronald Reagan in Iran-Contra turned over his diaries. This president seems absolutely firm that he is not going to yield, and the Congress seems firm that they are not going to quit pushing. And so I think this is going to be one of these titanic struggles, and it really does go to the administration's basic view of executive power. And I think this is just going to go on and on and on.
Stephen Spruill, do you think this is a front on which the president's conservative base is likely to stick with him? Is that a popular position on this much executive privilege? I mean, we've got the irony of a president with very low poll numbers claiming very high privilege. How does that sell?
Well, regardless of his poll numbers, the constitutional issues remain the same. And to the extent that I've been able to take the temperature of various conservatives and conservative commentary, you know, they support the president on this to the extent that they're even paying attention. I mean, mostly they see this as an investigation that is purely political. Patrick Leahy and the Democrats are doing this because their base wants to see this investigated. And I think the president is clearly ready to take this to court. So I think Karen's right. That's where we'll see this decided.
Jack, a purely political investigation motivation here?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there are a compelling public interest here that would trump any claim of executive privilege, which is nowhere mentioned in the Constitution. After all, we may have had the case here of using U.S. attorneys as part of a political agenda to prosecute Democrats on the one hand and go easy on Republicans on the other. And that's a perversion of our justice system. That's turning the Justice Department into a hack department. And you know, potentially that's even an impeachable offense. So I don't think this is just a fishing expedition. There's fish there.
Let's go, Karen.
Tom,
please.
If I could just add too that the deal that the White House is offering here to Congress, which is that we will let these people talk to you, we will let Harriet Myers talk, we will let Karl Rove talk, but there can be no record. They will not be under oath, and there will be no record made of anything that they say. Is understandably a non-starter as far as Congress is concerned.
And so there it stands, and the courts will have to make it. I mean, they'll either pick it up or they won't. They'll have a status quo to stare at. Let's go to Richard in Southbury, Connecticut. Richard, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to return to the subject of the Iraq war.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm coming from is I'm a Democrat. I opposed the war in the beginning, before it started. I agree with Senator McCain, however, that we must not get out of Iraq, and I'm wondering what the panel members think of what will be the long-term consequences to the U.S. if we withdraw as early as April 2008.
Which is exactly what the House voted for last night. Karen Tumbledy, what about this? The president's been putting this front and center. John McCain, too. If we go, you'll see what happens. It'll be hell on earth. The U.S. ambassador there, Ryan Crocker, saying something similar early this week. Do the Democrats have an effective counter to that, Karen?
Well, I'm not a military expert, and certainly Richard puts his finger on an argument that we're hearing a lot. But I do think that what people want to know is what good are we doing there? And we had this interim report this week from the Pentagon saying that on these benchmarks, these measurements of progress in Iraq, the outlook is very, very mixed.
Stephen Spruill, I mean, you've got that mixed outlook. Bad things could happen. Bad things are happening now.
Yeah, that's true. And as to the long-term consequences, I think those are largely unknowable. But what I am hearing from military experts and analysts that I talk to, and I'm no military expert myself, but the consensus appears to be that we either need to stay and let the surge work, or we need to get out completely. And this approach that Congress is taking, that we can somehow reduce our force by half, leave troops there just to do counterterrorism missions and train Iraqi forces. Most say, as Stephen Biddle did in the Washington Post this week, that that would merely increase our troop casualties because we wouldn't have enough troops on the ground to protect those doing the counterterrorism operations and training operations. So I think Congress is looking for a political solution, this middle ground that most experts agree just isn't going to work. We need to either stay in and stay firm in our commitment or just get out.
Jack, lots of variations on that theme out there, though. We're hearing about the possibility of bases or base in the north among the Kurds, or that you've got to have somebody sitting at the edge so it doesn't become the regional conflagration. I mean, do you see a simple in-out black-white here, Jack?
Well, I did read that Biddle piece, and I found it persuasive simply because if you're training, you're not protecting your own forces, and it would leave our people very vulnerable while they were doing that. On the other hand, if we don't do any training, how can these people possibly defend themselves? You know, when you start to look, I mean, Richard raises a good question, but when you start to look at what we're actually doing, it seems that what we're doing is counterproductive. For one thing, we're supposed to be, you know, the whole point of the surge was to create the space where the government would, you know, reach these agreements. It isn't. It doesn't seem to want to. So the political rationale for the surge has failed. And then when you look at the mission, according to one estimate, we make 1,000 patrols a week. And each patrol may go into, I don't know, some say as many as 30 houses. Well, if that's 30,000 houses a week, even if it's 15,000 houses a week, in how many of those houses is a woman embarrassed and a man embarrassed in front of his wife? How many people get slapped? How many people get clubbed? How many people get humiliated? And how many people does that recruit for the insurgency? And so, you know, the idea that we're making progress because we're making patrols, it may be just the opposite. So I think Richard has got to face up to the fact that we may be doing the wrong thing there simply by the strategy we're pursuing.
Let me go to Charles in Beverly Hills, California. Charles, hi, you're on the air.
What I'd like to say is I think that the Democrats and the Republicans, and let me identify myself, I'm a liberal Democrat.
Okay.
I think the Democrats and Republicans can have conversations and vacillate. Should we get out? When should we get out? How should we get out? And I think what the Democrats need is strong, strong leadership. And I think that one of the big deficits that the Democrats have is Senator Harry Reid, who I don't see as a leader at all. He puts me to sleep. And I think if he was replaced with a personality like Russ Feingold, a strong leadership personality, there could be progress. I will say that the Republican side of the aisle, they have strong leadership in terms of personality. And then I'd like to add one more thing.
Yeah.
I'd like to say Nancy Pelosi let all us liberal Democrats down on the night in November when we won the election. The first thing she said was, impeachment is off the table. I couldn't get that at all.
Charles, we got it. Your appetite is high. Karen Tumbledy, what about it? We talked with Russ Feingold earlier this week, Pete Domenici, too. There's Harry Reid, Democratic leadership in the Senate, and you hear Charles. He just doesn't feel the fire or the presence to push this agenda. Is it a matter of charisma?
Well, if I can defend Harry Reid here, the job that he has got to be the second hardest job in Washington, being Senate Majority Leader. The most successful Senate Majority Leaders have not been the strong personalities, the big national spokesmen, because the fact is that, you know, it's been compared to herding cats so often that that's a cliche. Mm. But it's all about getting the, you know, 60 votes that you need on any issue to actually get anything done. And that is all about internal persuasion. And it's a very, very hard job.
Well, a tough job. Charles would like to see maybe somebody else doing it. Let's go to Lansing, Michigan. And Steve, hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a very interesting, your panelist. A couple of questions. I believe that those Republicans that may be against the war at this point in time are up for re-election, and what that
most of them are. Yes, yeah.
Well, also, I want to know. President, I listened to his press conference yesterday, mm-hmm. and I like the answer he gave to Helen Thomas on the ideology of Saddam Hussein, because President Clinton said the exact same thing when he gave the address to the nation in December 16th, 1998. I mean, almost verbatim, that it is an ideology that he had these weapons. And how are we going to attack an ideology that hates America in such a manner?
But Saddam Hussein's gone, and there weren't any weapons. Awkwardly.
There weren't any weapons, but we're still fighting an ideology. It took nine guys, to fly 747s into buildings, and it didn't take weapons to do that.
Steve, let us pick that up. You raised something interesting. Steve Spruill, a lot of controversy about President Bush's repeated reference to al-Qaeda in his press conference yesterday. Al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda. Kind of a battle line's drawn over whether we're really talking about one thing or many here, whether it's Osama bin Laden's gang in Iraq or something different, Stephen.
Right. Well, I saw that several newspapers have picked up on that today, on critics saying, well, he's conflating al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, which is the group of largely foreign fighters who are responsible for most of the suicide terrorism in Iraq.
Well, I don't know if it's largely foreign. I mean, I'm reading otherwise today, but perhaps. Okay.
Well, the insurgency is obviously made up of several different factions, but this particular one, at least according to my understanding, is largely made up of foreign fighters who have come across the border, and that's the group that our counterinsurgency operations are directed to now. And if I could just speak to this point of whether or not we're doing more harm than good over there, part of the progress that's been reported from our operations now is that Sunni Iraqis are turning against al-Qaeda for the first time because they've lived under al-Qaeda rule in certain parts of Iraq, and they didn't like what was happening. They did not like the strict adherence to Islamic law and the brutal penalties for breaking the law. Mm-hmm. So you have Sunnis cooperating with American forces for the first time in a big way.
Glimmer of hope there. The president points very hard at it. At the same time, Jack, we've got Nick Kristof here is quoting polls out of Iraq, BBC and others taking them, saying only 21% of Iraqis think the U.S. troop presence improves security. 69% thinks it's making security worse. That's not exactly a popular vote of approval from Iraqis.
No, it isn't. And when you look at the ground zero of what's supposed to be the most secure place, the green zone, 20 rockets and mortar shells fell on it last week, one on Tuesday. It killed three people, including a U.S. soldier, and wounded another 25. And there were 39 of these attacks in May, 17 of them in March.
We're looking at a week in the news. A lot going on this week. Fire engulfing western states. It took Molly Marshall's home at Lake Tahoe.
It looked like a tornado of flames. The roar of it, you could hear it. It was so close.
China struggling to restore its product safety reputation. Its food and drug czar executed.
This lawbreaking by a small number of corrupt elements has brought shame upon our whole administration.
Ichiro Suzuki of the Seattle Mariners making history with a first for baseball's All-Star Game.
Here comes Ichiro, inside the park home run.
And Wall Street trading closes yesterday with an all-time high for the Dow Jones. A whole lot of hoopla going on right there. We've got Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine with us, Stephen Spruill from the National Review, Jack Beatty's here. I want to turn and look, if I could, at the Surgeon Generals, three of them on Capitol Hill. Most bracingly, President Bush's former Surgeon General, Richard Carmona, Capitol Hill on Tuesday, talking about interference from the White House when he wanted to talk about the value of science, or in particular in this quote, of condoms in avoiding unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases.
There was already a policy in place that did not want to hear the science, but wanted to just, if you will, quote unquote, preach abstinence, which I felt was scientifically incorrect.
Karen Tumulty, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about what's happening to science in the face of politics, ideology, but maybe never so clearly on display as this week with the three surgeons general sitting right there in front of Congress.
Oh, I think absolutely. This is a theme that we have heard a lot of in this administration, whether it is, scientists saying that they've been muzzled on global warming. In fact, reports that global warming reports in the White House are being rewritten and edited by people who are basically lobbyists for the energy industry. this is a theme we've heard a lot, but certainly Richard Carmona was not only eloquent, but the nature of the Surgeon General, it basically is an advocacy job. This man, all he has is his voice, and he was arguing that that had been muzzled. And, of course, Everett Koop and, you know, this is not a new problem to the Surgeon General's office. It has happened to all of them to some degree or another. But all three of them seem to agree that it has never happened as dramatically as it has in this administration.
Stephen Spruill, do you see a different role getting carved out here? I mean, the Surgeon General saying he was required to use George Bush's name three times per page, cut off from a bunch of venues, but maybe most importantly saying he couldn't speak straight about science. I mean, doesn't our economy depend, and for that matter, maybe our lives at some level on science?
I don't think that our lives depend at all on anything that the Surgeon General says. I mean, look, this guy is a figurehead, and honestly, you know, does anybody here remember Jocelyn Elders? Is it any wonder that Bush wanted to keep this person from sounding off on controversial topics? I mean, look how much trouble it can get an administration in. You know, I don't think that there's really any need for a Surgeon General.
Why not? The public health is something of significant importance. Presidents don't come to the White House with scientific or medical backgrounds. I mean, isn't there value in having someone standing there and saying, here's what we know about science, here's how it might intersect most effectively with the public good?
We have an entire Department of Health and Human Services that devotes quite a bit of energy to that task, and to have this this figurehead whose only job is to sound off on controversial topics. I mean, we really have enough of that already in Congress.
There's another clip I've got here. Carmona again. He was, of course, the Surgeon General from 02 to 06. Here he is saying he wanted to go and speak to a group affiliated with the Special Olympics. You know, that's the Olympics for handicapped. And it's got a long-time association with the Kennedys through the Shriver family. You'll hear an allusion to that right here.
I put in my paperwork to go to this meeting where I was going to give the keynote address and actually ride a bike with a disabled child and hope to bring some light to this problem in our nation. And I was admonished for doing that. And the reason I was admonished for doing that was that, unfortunately, I was told that I would be helping a politically prominent family who is, this is one of their endeavors, and why would I want to help those people? And I said, this is about sick kids.
Jack Beatty, sick kids, politics, it's all in there.
Sick kids and politics, and of course the politics, it comes out the his immediate superior was a woman who had somehow doctored her credentials, a political hack, in short. You know, if people, in a recent Pew poll, people were asked, what's the first word that comes to mind when you think of President Bush? And they said incompetence, overwhelmingly. But it isn't just incompetence. As we look at it, what Bush is competent at, and Rove is competent at, is staffing the government with his with politicos, with people who are going to play their game. It's like a vast political machine.
Don't all presidents do that?
Well, there are degrees, aren't there? I mean, have we ever had anything quite like this firing of the U.S. attorneys, quite like the clear pattern of prosecutions that were developed there? Have we ever had a Surgeon General, you know, having to put being required to, you know, like a Stalinist dictator having to put in Bush's name on three times on every page? Have we ever had this kind of thing with Nasser and all the rest? I don't think so. And, you know, there's been a kind of political machine run here, and it's worked politically. It's just that it's incompetent in terms of delivering the services.
Stephen, I hear you there.
Look, if I could just jump in for a minute here, especially on this anecdote about the Special Olympics and the Kennedys. I mean, this is just doesn't pass the smell test. Okay, President Bush has worked with Ted Kennedy on three important legislative initiatives. You had No Child Left Behind. Kennedy was on board with the Medicare reform for a while, and then this latest immigration bill. He's appeared.
You're saying Carmona is lying, that he's stupid, he didn't know what was going on. He was saying this to Congress in sworn testimony.
He wouldn't go. Well, you know, I'm just saying it doesn't. Yeah. It does not pass the smell test.
Yeah, Karen, what about it? Is this an administration that from the pattern you've seen, we can believe that they might have been interfering with the Surgeon General's public face at that level of detail?
Well, first of all, it would have been interesting if he could have identified who the person was who said this to him. So that you could have a sense of whether this was some, you know, individual staffer run amok or whether this was some expression of government policy.
But does that really matter? I mean, we've seen young staffers in NASA, you know, pushing around veteran scientists.
Yes, and we've seen, you know, young staffers at the Justice Department essentially having hiring and firing authority over assistant U.S. attorneys. We've seen, going back to Katrina, Michael Brown was an instance where somebody got their job because of their political connections, and it was a particular job that really required a lot of expertise and ability.
But is there a question in your mind at this point, Karen, that politics have been pushed deeper into the fabric of American government than they have been, I don't know, ever before in a long time? Jack says so. Stephen says not. What do you think?
Well, I don't think it's just in my mind. I think it's something that has been demonstrated, and certainly it is a very, very strong feeling for a lot of career staff people who work in a lot of different government agencies. And certainly going back to the Florida recount, Dick Cheney was sitting at his kitchen table. This is a very famous story. With gigantic organizational charts of the U.S. government, this administration went into office with the belief that if they really wanted to change the way things were operating in Washington, if they really wanted to make sure that the goals and the priorities of this administration were being followed, that they really were going to have to essentially change the way government operated right down to the very, very lowest levels of the bureaucracy.
Let's go to our listeners. Dave is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I was listening to your panel with great interest before about Myers, and I think you're somewhat off the mark on the options that are available to the House of Representatives.
She didn't even show up. She took executive privilege here, and no documents, no body, no testimony. What do you think the options are?
Well, however, what the House can do on a simple majority vote is to pursue Myers on an inherent contempt charge. And on a simple majority vote, supposing it passes, they can then send the sergeant-at-arms down to Myers with the Washington, D.C. police, pick her up, bring her back to the House chamber, and try her right there in the House chamber with Nancy Pelosi presiding over the trial.
Oh, my gosh. Then Stephen Spruill's cannons really would be pointed up and down Pennsylvania Avenue. I don't know the law. Karen, is that true? Can Congress do that?
You know, I don't know the law here either, but I do think that this is not exactly the visual that the Democrats in Congress want.
Harriet in chains.
The last time this was done was in 1934 with the United States Senate versus the Postmaster General, and it was done successfully. He spent 10 days in jail.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Jack, can you see Harriet being kind of flogged up Pennsylvania Avenue?
Ooh. We've had those scenarios. Joe Wilson is always talking about, you know, Karl Rove being frog marched into a jail. But you know, that phrase that Dave used, inherent contempt, I think that applies across the board to this administration. That's their attitude toward Congress, inherent contempt.
Let's go to Fall River, Massachusetts, and Christina. You're on the air, Christina.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
I'm calling. I joined the conversation a little bit late, but I heard the comment around the Surgeon General discussing his inability to attend a Special Olympics
speech. Yeah.
And the comment from one of the gentlemen on your panel was that it doesn't pass the smell test because President Bush has worked with Senator Kennedy on a number of initiatives.
Yes.
Those initiatives he worked on because they behooved him. It seems to me that that's a sign of Senator Kennedy working with the president. I don't think there's anything too petty for this government, this administration. I believe the Surgeon General completely. There's no reason for him to lie on this occasion.
But immigration, that was pretty big, and they were on the same page. No Child Left Behind. Education's a pretty. Those don't sound like petty issues where they did stand together.
And the fact that they may agree on some occasions doesn't mean that this administration will not do something that doesn't behoove them. If it does not inure to their benefit or does not follow their path, they're not going to waste their time with it. And the fact that it might help someone else is not relevant.
Christina, thanks very much. We hear the point. We heard Stephen Spruill's earlier, painting it the other way. Let's take another call from Framingham, Massachusetts. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to say that I find that most people on and off the air in the walks, the quarters of government, are not speaking about the climate of fear that this administration has perpetrated, and I really believe that with the onset, with the fall of the Twin Towers, which I question, exactly what happened there.
Climate of fear, are we still stuck in it?
We are completely stuck in it, and I think it just keeps perpetuating. The woman before me, I agree with her wholeheartedly on the Surgeon General piece, and also that I don't even believe that when Bush went after the immigration bill. I mean, I have no idea why he would want to support, out of his compassionate heart, these immigrants, because he's totally uncompassionate. And I think it was everything he goes after, if you just look at what he's tried to do, the opposite happens. So for me, it's always like whatever he goes after, just think he really probably wants the opposite.
Sharon, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. I want to bring another voice in here. Lady Bird Johnson, dead this week at age 94. And here's an interesting kind of intersection of some of the things we're talking about. This is some tape from an audio diary where she speaks about seeing Jackie Kennedy after her husband, President John F. Kennedy, was assassinated. Kind of brings back a different time, a terrible moment, but the passing of quite a figure this week with Lady Bird Johnson. Here's that moment in her voice.
Mrs. Kennedy's dress was stained with blood. One leg was almost entirely covered with it. And her right glove was caked. That immaculate woman, it was caked with blood, her husband's blood. She always wore gloves like she was used to them. I never could. And that was somehow one of the most poignant sights. Exquisitely dressed and caked in blood.
Caked in blood. Jack Beatty, I don't know, some value here in just of the voice of history and looking at this figure. Lady Bird Johnson, gone at 94, worked to beautify the country, get the billboards off the sides of the highways, lived a long, long time.
A gracious woman who made a real contribution to the beautification of the country and, helped to persuade her husband to step down in 1968, not to run again. She said to him, Lyndon, remember what happened to Woodrow Wilson. You don't want that to happen to you. And, of course, what happened to Wilson is that he had a stroke in his second term, which disabled him for the rest of his life. And she was very instrumental in that decision, which I think was for the best for Johnson as well as for the country. Mm.
Stephen Spruill, another southern state in the news this week. Senator David Vitter, been a big family values champion, and now he said, I've sinned. His phone number, of course, in the records of the D.C. madam, the alleged hooker ring. Does he last in Louisiana? Is this a firing offense in Louisiana, Stephen?
In Louisiana?
Yes.
perhaps any other state. I don't know what to say about that, except for that I think his claims that it's a private personal issue ring a little false when he has when the Congress has direct control over whether or not prostitution is legal in the District of Columbia. So he's more or less admitted to breaking a law that he has the power to change. So I think that it's rightly in the news, and he'll have to go home and face his electorate.
Yeah, and his electorate.
Of course, they're
and
used
his
to
wife.
This.
Well, maybe, but his wife is on the record a couple of years ago saying, when it comes to infidelity, she's in the Lorena Bobbitt camp. So, watch out, Senator. It's been great having all of you. Karen Tumbledy, national correspondent, political correspondent for Time Magazine. Karen, it's always a treat to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Stephen Spruill with the National Review and National Review Online. Stephen, welcome. Great to have you for the first time. Hope you'll come back.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Jack Beatty, good to have you as always, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.